Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, we take a look at Wisconsin's fiscal outlook, what it could mean for the next state budget cycle, and your wallet. Plus, the fate of the state's chief election officer was before the state Supreme Court as justices debate how long appointments can stay in their roles. And Republican Eric Hovde concedes in the U.S. Senate race nearly 2 weeks after the election. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for November 22nd.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This week, we're going to begin looking at the state's finances as we got new projections as what the state is likely going to have a big chunk of change heading into the new year. Now, the state is now projected to finish the 2023-2025 state budget with a $4 billion surplus. That's with a B. Now, state agencies, which we touched on a little bit last week, have requested a combined $5.6 billion in new spending over the next biennium. And the Evers administration now expects that $1.7 billion and new tax collections will occur over the following two-year period. Now, this latest projection, let's start with the $4 billion, is $500 million more than what was projected, which is always good news. But of course, heading into a new year, lawmakers and the governor and Democrats, Republicans always want different things when looking at the state's finances.
So first off, these numbers all come with caveats. One, the Evers administration wrote in the letter that, hey, we've got a lot of uncertainty. Okay, so we'll get to that in a second. But with what they're asking for from state agencies, they never get everything they ask for. It never, ever happens. But this actually underscores what they're asking. The big upper is $4.3 billion in new money from Department of Public Instruction, a lot of that going toward K-12 education, increasing reimbursement rates for special education. So that entire pie is not going to get done because Republicans want to use this money for tax cuts. We both heard Robin Voss say repeatedly he wants to use this money to return to the taxpayers. That's been the message from Republicans all along. A couple of interesting things to watch in this process. So one, this is the foundation of the budget. Governor now will get numbers from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau in January. That's the nonpartisan budget arm of the legislature. He'll work those into his budget proposal likely in February. We'll get that speech. Joint Finance Committee will start kicking around probably in April. May, they get going kind of full force. June, they polish it off. If we're on time.
Right. I was going to say, you never know.
Then they try and pass it before the fiscal year ends June 30th. Big question, education first. Remember, in this past budget, Governor uses his veto authority to basically built in an increase from pure pupil spending for the next 400 years. Now, the Supreme Court of Wisconsin has heard oral arguments in that case and could strike that down or uphold it at any minute now. So there's that. But if it stays, big question is, okay, do you backfill that increase? Remember, it's a cap on spending between state aid and property taxes. The more state aid goes in, less property taxes you can raise to cover that cost. Well, will Republican lawmakers want to put in enough money to backfill that, we call it in government, not allow a property tax increase? Or do they go, hey, governor did this, we're going to kind of keep it flat, let the property taxes go up and say it's Evers' fault because
there's an
election.
Look, we
warned you. Yeah. There's an election in 2 years. Mm-hmm. Okay, a big question there. But what we do know is Republicans aren't going to spend this money or say they're not going to spend the money on expanding government. They want to cut taxes. Another complicating factor is $5.6 billion is a lot of money that they're asking for. They're actually asking for even more because Department of Health Services built a budget proposal with the assumption that we'd expand Medicaid. Medicaid expansion has been kicked around for three straight budgets by Governor Evers, rejected every time by Republicans. They estimate it would save $1.7 billion. So if you don't do Medicaid expansion, you add that to the 5.6 for what the really agencies need or want, I should say, not need, want to do. And oh, by the way, you take the $4 billion surplus, the $1.7 billion in new money they expect to come in the next 2 years, add in all the agency requests and some other things, we still would end up $743 million in the hole if they funded everything. Now, again, never going to happen.
Right.
But it underscores the give me more from agencies, especially DPI.
Right, and you kind of hinted at this earlier in the note that the Evers administration issued with the new projection is they kind of warned of some uncertainty into the future, specifically with President-elect Donald Trump. So looking at the estimate notes, the challenge projected revenues over the next 2 years, basically when it comes to issues like policy, trade, and immigration. President-elect Donald Trump has promised things like mass deportations of those who are in the country without documentation. He also ran on imposing tariffs and imports and extending tax cuts that were put in place during his first administration that largely benefited wealthy individuals and wealthy businesses. So this really, if all of that happens, now, of course, he has to get these proposals and policy initiatives through Congress, then that could change the environment here in Wisconsin, depending on what lawmakers want to do, if they want to be more reserved or spend more.
Yeah, so and then the end of this entire conversation is people keep talking about, oh, why this happened, the $4 billion surplus. Why it happened? They couldn't agree.
Yeah.
Remember,
yeah.
Evers vetoed a tax cut.
It was a tennis match. Yeah.
So the reason those monies are not because of good stewardship, or it's because they couldn't agree on how to spend it, and governor vetoed it, and they just went and sat there. That's why I have $4 billion in the bank. We fast forward to watch this budget play out, because it also hints at the bigger issue of the next session of, what are they going to get done? If you pull back and think about it, that 400-year veto that Evers issued, they weren't getting along very well beforehand. They did get, in 2023, a big deal done on shared revenue, which is state aid to local governments, an education package that benefited public education, and choice in charter schools. They got the Bucks Arena done, but
Brewers Arena.
But they weren't real happy with each other after the whole veto thing. So is there an incentive to do much in this next session? Because if you think about it, Republicans want to limit the wins, they call it, for Governor Evers. Governor Evers is going, look, I might run again in 2026. It could be a good year for us. We could flip both chambers. Do I want to agree to a tax cut and run it like he did in 2022? He signed a tax cut in 2021, ran on it in 2022. Don't do that again, or do you want to see that money kind of stay there and think about what Democrats could do in 2020? I mean, it's a lot of stuff, moving pieces, but I'm watching for what can they get done this session. Is it going to be a lot of small stuff and messaging bills? Like, I'm sure you're going to see some more transgender stuff come up.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
Right? But what else are they going to get done? What is there to get done? Well, there's hospital funding, PFAS, Lincoln Hills is still open. So they have stuff to do, but can they agree on anything, Emily, is my question.
Right. That's going to be a big question. And we thought, depending on the election outcome, how are the chambers going to look? They're going to be a lot different. The Assembly is working with a smaller majority, but Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has a comfortable majority where it's not going to create headaches for him, per se, to pass his legislation. Meanwhile, in the state Senate, that's what I'm going to be interested in watching for, because now it's an 18-15 split. They may need some Democrats, depending on what they want to pass in both chambers and get to Governor Tony Evers' desk. He doesn't, you know, looking at the Senate, too, you don't have Senator Dewey Strobel there anymore, which is a lot of no votes. Now you have a new Senate president. Does that change things at all, change the dynamic? Who knows? But it's going to be fascinating to see what they get done and whether or not they're going to have to need Democratic support. Because typically, Republicans, I mean, point blank, last year, in the past several years, they could get any bill through the legislature. And yes, they knew that Governor Evers would likely veto some of their bills, like transgender issues, et cetera. But it's still about messaging, and they do it. But does it keep getting stalled in the Senate? One bill that I'm specifically focused on is what's going to happen to the Monday processing bill. We know there's interest in that. It's a bipartisan bill. But is it going to get done this year? I mean, we all know no one really liked to see results coming in at 4 a.m. But that's something. At least one piece of legislation we know there's interest in, but is it going to stall again in the Senate is going to be a good question. All right, let's move on to the state Supreme Court this week, as the fate of the chief election officer, Megan Wolf, was before the state Supreme Court. Now, this goes back all the way, which is a huge longstanding argument over holdover positions and appointments. So the arguments basically would decide, can Wolf remain in her role. She is the administrator of the state elections commissions. Now, justices, specifically liberal justices, really grappled with the issue over whether Wolf can stay in her job after her term expired. So they often pointed to a court decision from 2 years ago that ruled appointees can remain in their positions until someone new is confirmed in the state Senate. This goes back to the DNR secretary, former one Fred Preen. Let's listen to the argument specifically from Justice Jill Karofsky pointing to that and saying, what do we need to really change? Because it's almost deja vu before the state Supreme Court. Let's take a listen.
Six of the seven of us sat in this courtroom 2 years ago when your client, Your client insisted that Fred Prehn should be able to retain his position on the DNR board even though his six-year term had expired, and your client won. This is a case of careful what you wish for, isn't it? And now the legislature is here 2 years later demanding that Megan Wolf must vacate her position. It seems to me this has little to do with what the law actually says and far more to do with who is in these positions.
I mean, look, there's a lot of arguments here. We've got to take a step back. This is the state's chief election officer. They are telling this court that who the state's chief election officer will be forever away from the people. That is not a sustainable result in a democracy.
There's kind of two options where the court could go on this issue, JR.
So, look, first, the Prehn decision you talked about. Fred Prehn is a Wausau dentist appointed to the Natural Resources Board. He stayed on, appointed by Scott Walker, he stayed on to block Evers' appointees from taking control, ideologically, of the Natural Resources Board. All right, so there's that thing. A holdover appointment, you can continue to serve after your appointment is over in certain situations, including in this situation where the Senate didn't act upon the appointing successor. Okay, that's one thing. The second avenue, though, is was there a duty to appoint, period? What I get at that is, so in the state law that Republicans wrote to create the Elections Commission, they set a four-year term for the Elections Administrator. There's a question of how those statutes were put together if they meant to say that you shall appoint somebody new every 4 years. Now, I've watched lawyers argue about what the definition of is, right? So attorneys can be creative in their arguments, but words matter. And in the arguments this week, lawyers for commissions kept saying, look, there's not an explicit you shall appoint every 4 years. Is there a duty? So what I'm wondering is the liberal justices on the court right now are all in the dissent on that Prehn decision. They did not like the idea of allowing this guy to serve indefinitely. That was a problem for them. And conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley kind of made a dig at them, like, why didn't you just asking the attorney for lawmakers, why don't you just ask them to us to adopt the dissent from that, you know, so anyway. But I'm wondering is, will those liberal justices say, we're not going to touch Prehn, we're going to stay away from that entire thing and just go the route of, is there a duty to appoint, because you could get away from not having to overturn that or adopting that, whatever you want to say, and focus on that one issue with this one case.
Right, and this case almost took a little bit to be heard before the state Supreme Court because I think we wanted to get an election over with. Yep. And people wanted to have an administrator there. I think the question is, does Megan still want to keep doing this job? I think it was a call shortly after the election. She was asked by a reporter on a press availability, you know, what are your thoughts? And she kind of danced around it like, hey, I'm focused on this election right now, getting the vote certified, et cetera. Some of the commissioners that I've talked to in recent weeks, they want her to stay on, but I think it's still going to just be a political talking point for quite some time. And as I think it was Assembly Speaker Robin Voss told reporters, too, 2 weeks ago that, hey, I think there's a lot of other qualified people that can do that job, but it's if you want this job, because it's no easy task.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to the next topic this week. After we got a familiar name that came back up that we haven't heard from for quite some time, which is former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman. Why? Because there was a complaint basically accusing him of lying and harassing public officials during the 2020 investigation into the 2020 election. Now, of course, Gableman had a taxpayer-funded salary. The whole thing costs about $2.3 million and didn't produce any results of widespread voter fraud. Gableman was hired by Voss, but was later fired after he kind of spewed a lot of conspiracy theories. So looking at some of the highlights of this report, now it was 75 pages of this complaint, and it was filed by the Wisconsin Office of Lawyer Regulation, which alleges Gableman violated multiple rules of professional conduct throughout the 14 months he was hired. So let's kind of go through some of the certain things. You know, they said that, you know, he had bad behavior, in a sense, before a Dane County judge, which is Frank Remington, when he was at issue of a lawsuit seeking records related to the election review. He got in kind of a spat with Judge Remington. Remington later held him in contempt of court, wrote up this report, and was how this whole process really began.
So I look at there are different layers of the complaint, but he lied to the public, lied to his client, and lied to the Office of Lawyer Regulation. So first with the public, which one big chunk of this complaint. Remember, Gableman tried to compel the mayors of Green Bay and Madison to sit for subpoenas in his private office in Waukesha County, not before a legislative committee. There was a big question whether that was legal. He claimed that they were basically not cooperating, even though they had basically turned over documents. There have been conversations about trying to arrange a deposition. So that's one level, like lying to the public about what's going on with that. Lying to his client. So Gabelman, in a 2023 disciplinary hearing for a Trump attorney, basically said he signed the contract under false pretenses. Robin Voss wanted, the Assembly Speaker wanted, a forward-looking report. What can we do in Wisconsin to shore up election procedures? Gabelman told this disciplinary hearing he didn't think that was serious. He planned all along to use pressure from the public to get Voss to give him more resources and time, which, by the way, happened. And then lying to OLR. So OLR accused Gabelman of violating attorney-client privilege because in these interviews during the recall election or recall effort against Voss, Gabelman was a very public figure in that, just basically discussed things he talked about with Voss. OLR says that violates attorney-client privilege. Gabelman made his argument, which, again, I'm not an attorney, but this one was kind of interesting to me, that he wasn't providing legal guidance or anything that established a attorney-client privilege with anybody in that contract. Even the contract says it's for legal services to the Assembly.
Says it pretty clear. Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious about that one. Again, not an attorney, not sure how you get around that one, but what his definition of is. This whole thing is interesting in that, you know, what's going to happen with Gabelman, how this process is going to play out. It also harkens back to the cost you talked about. So the $2.3 million they had in the complaint does include $441,000 in legal fees that the state's now on the hook for to American Oversight, which sued for records, the open records law, through Office of Special Counsel. Also, I found legal bills from this spring that showed that the state's been picking up the cost for Gabelman's attorneys for an OLR matter. I put that in quotes because that's what's said in the document that I got back in March. Basically, Robin Voss, the original deal that he signed with Gabelman, didn't include this, but an amendment signed in May of 2022, I believe it was, promised to indemnify, they call it, Gabelman. It's basically, anything happens legally, you're on the hook for it. We are as taxpayers.
Right.
That's why this bill can keep going up, because this process now plays out where the Supreme Court will appoint a referee, oversee this case. There could be an evidentiary hearing, which both you and I know Gabelman. He enjoys a spotlight, shall we say.
Yes.
That could be a whole circus, people tell me. And then it goes to the Supreme Court for final word what's going on. But this is going to play out for a while and cost taxpayers more money in the process.
Right. We're going to touch on a little bit what possible consequences he could face. But we've even heard from Speaker Voss. He wants to see Gabelman disbarred. He called him, appointing him to begin with, an embarrassment, mm-hmm. a disappointment. And I think the most troubling thing, I think, for a lot of people, because this was a huge saga that we talked about the show for over a year, is how much money that was invested into this probe to begin with, when Democrats, I think, all along were a little skeptical of what they were looking for. Mm-hmm. He also was cited in the complaint for lying to lawmakers on the Assembly Elections Committee when he testified and said that basically was lying about his conversations that he had with the mayors of Green Bay and Madison. So there was a lot in that report, mm-hmm. but it was almost just fascinating to look back on all of that, because it was a long period of time and a lot of issues that we covered along the way. All right, let's move on to another election-related story, is that Eric Hovde has finally conceded in his defeat against Senator Tammy Baldwin. So he posted another updated video, basically accepting his narrow loss to Baldwin. And in his concession video, he acknowledged his defeat and also, you know, this comes after he left open the possibility of a recount. He also touched on a little bit of what his political future may look like. So let's take a listen.
A request for a recount would serve no purpose, because you will just be recounting the same ballots regardless of their integrity. As a result, and my desire to not add to political strife through a contentious recount, I've decided to concede the election. As for my future, I don't know what it holds. After running from morning to night for 9 months and leaving it all on the field, I will take a much-needed break, then return to my businesses and foundation and find other ways to make a positive impact. One thing is certain. I will always fight for the country and state that I love and work to restore the American dream.
In the nearly six-minute video, Hovde also went back to the same claims that we kind of debunked last week, you know, pointing blame at Milwaukee Central Count for, you know, putting having the results in at 4 a.m., which dramatically changed the results, which did favor Baldwin because there are more Democrats in that area. He, you know, kind of called them once again ballot dumps. It just takes them a long time to process these absentee ballots. He also brought up again third-party candidate Leaguer, you know, claimed that this was a plan by Democrats that has also been debunked, and he's also been on the record saying, no, I ran as a Republican, things about that. But, you know, point blank is when it comes to how long results get in and how long it takes officials to count ballots, it's going to keep happening in the state until lawmakers pass legislation changing otherwise. But I think what's interesting, too, is that you kind of tiptoe about what his political future may look like, JR. And, you know, I think what I heard from conservatives weeks ago when he didn't, you know, concede right away is that he possibly hurt his reputation by not, you know, accepting the results right away.
Yeah, it depends if it's right on a check. That's what people told me this week. So let's talk first about Leaguer. Canvas statements are in from counties, the official results to the Elections Commission. They haven't certified them yet. They have until the summer 1st to do that. We went through every county canvas statement this week. Baldwin's win was on official results, more than the number of votes that Leaguer got, who did get help from Democrats get on the ballot. But even if every Leaguer voter had cast ballots for Hovde, he wouldn't have been over the top of Baldwin. Yes, it would have made for a more interesting recount. If we're talking like hundreds of votes, not a thousand. But, you know, it wouldn't have changed things most likely, unless you're going to do, again, hand-to-hand combat, going through every municipality, finding ballots that weren't counted the first time, all that kind of good stuff. But his future, I mean, people kept pointing out to me this week that, look, Donald Trump didn't admit defeat for four full years. Ran again in 2024, saying he basically won in 2020. Didn't ever concede to Joe Biden, still won. Now, Trump is a unique figure. But with Hovde, people told me, the average voter, they pay attention to this. They know it took a week and a half or so for him to concede. Probably not. And the reality is, if Hovde wants to write a big check again to run, that would help. I mean, we've seen a string of very wealthy business people in Wisconsin who write big checks, who do well in primaries. That's the reality of the situation. So, what's it look like? Well, what's he want to do? What's he want to put in? Also, don't forget, he had a chance for governor in 2022 and passed. So he says his issue more like in his wheelhouse is more about federal issues. Okay, well then that means Ron Johnson in 2028. Ron Johnson is what he's going to do. So there's a gap there between now and then that things will cool, people forget. So long term, probably no serious damage. But again, does he want to spend $20 million again? Like, I don't have that much money to
right.
pay the campaign.
And for if you're a state party and say, hey, if you want to self-fund your campaign, go right ahead. Yes. We'll use our resources elsewhere. All right, let's get on to our last topic this week, which is about the Department of Public Instruction, and their new report cards that were released. Now, the big headline from them is that 94% of the state's public school districts, quote, meets expectations or better, according to this year's report cards from the 2023-2024 school year. But critics have accused DPI of lowering its testing standards too far, while the agency maintains that these cutoffs, kind of marking proficiency in reading and math, are now more representative of the state's students. So that has been kind of the longstanding argument since they changed these policies. So let's hear from DPI officials kind of defending that. And then we also spoke to the Wisconsin Policy Forum, who kind of touched on it's kind of really extremely difficult to compare any years past with these new standards in place. So let's take a listen.
The process itself was transparent and 100% necessary. So to say that the data that we release is not accurate, or I think the quote that was used in the question was worthless, is just very, very short-sighted. And I think that if you really take a look at the data in there, you'll see a lot of valuable uses for it. And I know we've heard from education leaders about how valuable report cards are.
What's tricky is that those ratings are based on a whole variety of factors, many of which rest on standardized test scores. And those tests and the cut scores associated with them changed this year. So our ability to understand what these results mean this year is compromised because we don't have a sense of how schools and districts changed using a common measurement. There isn't a crosswalk to help us understand what do scores or results this year mean compared to previous years.
So you heard kind of both sides on the issue here with report cards. Let's look at what the results show on some of the state's largest school districts. Looking at your screen, Madison meeting expectations. Milwaukee, same thing. Racine didn't do so well, meets few expectations. Looking at, like I said, some of the larger school districts also in the kind of the Milwaukee area too. But when you talk to people in Milwaukee, they don't really believe that the school district, after all of their kind of financial woes too, are they really meeting expectations?
And so that's when the hits on DPI and Jill Underley, the state superintendent, kind of this pushback on whether she's really being honest with voters about what's happening in these school districts. Speaking of voters, the state Democratic Party this week endorsed Underley for re-election. Now, that's an interesting development because the party has a lot of resources. She's got one challenger so far. We're waiting to see if others get in who are more right of center, but that's a nice boost for her in terms of politics. They have the state party on her side.
It's definitely an issue that will be coming up next year for the state Supreme Court race. All right, let's get to stock picks this week. And rising Wisconsinite and former Congressman Sean Duffy, because he was tapped for the Trump administration.
Yeah, more of a New Jerseyan right now. He's been out there for a few years on TV at Fox. But former Congressman from Northern Wisconsin, Sean Duffy, tapped for Transportation Secretary. Now, look, Duffy's time in Congress, his focus committee-wise is on financial services, that industry. He did lobby a little bit after he left Congress, did do some transportation stuff, but he's not really a roads and bridges kind of guy in terms of experience. But in talking to people about his appointment, their point was, it's not about that. It's about being a messenger. It's about being good on TV, being a leader, and being loyal to Donald Trump. And Duffy has all those things in spades. So he's been a big Trump supporter for a long time, great on TV. He can mess you need a good deputy or deputies who know the industry or the department inside and out to go run things, know where to go for stuff. Another question for Duffy is, does this mean something for his future politically? I checked. He still had $2.1 million in his congressional account from his days in the House. It's been sitting there now. He left in 2019. What's he want to do with that? I don't know this is a springboard to another political run. Also, he's basically in New Jersey. Now, it's not hard to reestablish residency, but they've lived out in New Jersey for a while. Well, he and Rachel, his wife, have been on TV with Fox News, so not sure this means a run back in Wisconsin anytime soon.
Right, because he stepped down originally from being a congressman because he had with nine kids. Yep. I think the youngest kid had some heart problems. But anyways, all right, let's get to Mix this week. Legislative experience because the new makeup in the legislature.
So look, there are 37 new faces. That's a lot. But it's not a record. We had 38 in 2011. That was after a big wave year for Republicans. But in diving down the numbers, okay, also the 37 include Dan Knoedel going from the Senate to the Assembly, not really a new face. Dean Coffert, who served for 14 or 16 years back in the 90s and early through 2015. So he's not really a new face in the Assembly. He's kind of a return. But still, a lot of turnover. But the deeper drill is, we have like only 20-some people in the Assembly who've been there for a decade, which, I don't know, a decade's a long time. Go back to that first kind of wave of after the 2010 wave, the 2014 wave, new maps in 2012. There are only like 15-ish people in the Assembly who had a decade of experience, so a little more experience in the Assembly than like a decade ago. Go to the Senate, though, different story.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go back to 2015, there were like still 14 people who have been in that chamber for a decade. Now we're down to 7. But a big turnover in the legislature in both houses. Now, it's also interesting to watch these dynamic of these new majorities. They're smaller. How do they function? Can they get stuff done? It's going to be an interesting session to watch for sure.
All right. And following this week is, again, Gableman. But what type of repercussions could he face?
Okay. So doing some research, the state Supreme Court has revoked, disbarred 4 people in the past year. Usually, you've done something really, really bad and illegal, too. Like, one guy threatened a client that unless she waived attorney-client privilege, he could write a book about a murder trial, he'd go after her. One woman, like, embezzled $1 million or so from a client, basically bilked her out of it. So, like, we're talking, like, serious stuff. And not to diminish what Gableman's done, which, you know, people will say undermining confidence in our democracy, right? But first-time offender, usually a slap on the wrist. But he's a unique first-time offender. He's also somebody who's a Supreme Court justice. Does that put a bigger target on him to be disciplined? And oh, by the way, who can hear the case? So let's go through this process. So I mentioned before, the referee, the hearing, then it goes to state Supreme Court. Well, looking at the court right now, Ann Walsh Bradley, a liberal, Rebecca Bradley, a conservative, and Annette Ziegler, a conservative, all served with Gabelman. Could they really sit on a case involving him? Brian Hagedorn, another conservative, clerked for Gabelman while he was on the Supreme Court. Could he hear it? Now, these things take months. So Ann Welch Bradley's retiring after this session. They wrap up oral arguments usually around April-ish, all right? So if they don't get anything before this late spring, will they push it off to the next session of the court? Maybe. But if it gets there now, what do you do? Who's going to hear it? You have to have four members to conduct any business. If those four step down off the case, you only got three. Don't forget, Justice David Prosser, former Justice David Prosser, had an altercation with Ann Welch Bradley back in 2011 over the Act 10 decision. There were six justices in the room when it happened. None were going to hear the case, left one person. That's why the case basically went away.
Right.
Gabelman actually had a complaint filed by the Judicial Commission over an ad he ran in the 08 campaign. They deadlocked 3-3 because he stepped off the case. So it could complicate things. Now, again, timing's going to matter. If it gets there next, after August 1st, there'll be new justice, so maybe it won't matter. But it could be a thing for Gabelman if this gets to the spring that it may kind of just go away.
Yeah, it could be an interesting saga. Yeah. All right, that will do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fanna.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next time.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, Your Week in Review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.